For South Carolina Public Radio, I'm Bradley Fuller. For composer Mayura Warshauer, the large scale of the symphonic form makes it an ideal medium for addressing large-scale issues. Issues like the natural world and the degradation it faces in human hands. Fittingly, the environmentally minded composer shaped her first symphony on themes from the natural world, drawing on the sounds of a summer evening, a particularly memorable boat ride on a tributary of the Amazon River, and the image of the Earth rotating in space. Recently, I had the chance to speak with Mayura about the work, and about how environmentalism and music making might intersect more generally speaking. Here's part of the conversation we had. Mayura, it's good to have you once again.
Thanks, Bradley. It's great to be back with you.
Now, you've been composing works since the 1970s.
The late 70s. I didn't start composing until I was in my late 20s. It was kind of influenced by the women's movement in Boston where I was living, yeah, that I could actually do something creative myself.
Did you have any particular figures that inspired you to get started?
Well, one thing is I signed up for a composition for non-majors at New England Conservatory. I was a piano major, and basically as soon as I started that, I knew that's what I wanted to do, and I just had to force myself to finish my degree, play my recital, and get into composing. But yeah, I mean, there wasn't a single person in that department. There was only one woman in the department at the time. And but a friend of mine said to me that she felt it was time for women to start composing more, and I kind of took that to heart.
Yeah. And certainly in that time, since then, you've written chamber and solo compositions, choral works, and orchestral compositions, including your Symphony No. 1, Living, Breathing Earth. Now, from what I've read about Brahms getting started on his Symphony No. 1 and some other composers, I know that can be a kind of big undertaking. Was this an easy next step for you, or did you really have to muster up some kind of new compositional energies to get started?
Well, it's a big project, but, you know, thankfully I had the backing at the outset of these three orchestras, the Dayton Symphony, Dayton Philharmonic, the South Carolina Philharmonic, and the Western Piedmont Symphony, and they promised me a little commission and that they would premiere it at the end. So once I knew that, it really gave me a possibility of starting something big. And yeah, you know, I called it Symphony No. 1. Honestly, I don't know if there's going to be a Symphony No. 2, so we may have to drop the No. 1 part, but maybe there'll be a Symphony No. 2. I don't know. I have some thoughts about the ocean. But yeah, it was a big undertaking, and I had so much support. I was at the Hambidge Center in Georgia where I wrote a lot of it, and I had support from the South Carolina Arts Commission. They had given me the Artist Fellowship in Composition in 2005 and 6. So that enabled me to spend the time with it, you know, as well as the commission. So I felt like people had my back and I could do it.
Yeah. Aside from those commissions and the people who are, you know, placing their trust in you to write this music, what else inspired you to shape this first symphony the way you did? I mean, what went into it in terms of maybe any sources of inspiration or topics or anything like that?
Well, I knew that I wanted to write something about the Earth. Even then, really for as long as, since the first Earth Day in 1970, I've been really an environmentalist, and things were really kind of heating up, to say it, you know, metaphorically, with the Earth. And I just felt called to connect with the Earth more deeply than I had before and through my music. And it was such a huge topic that I felt like the symphonic form would be, I would need that much. And I didn't necessarily set out to have it be four movements, but that's kind of the way it developed. While I was at the Hambidge Center, even before I went to the Hambidge Center, I was really enamored by the sound of the cicadas. I grew up in North Carolina on the coast, and of course we have those summer sounds too, like we have in South Carolina, and I was living in South Carolina, and I just loved the antiphonal sounds of the cicadas, and it just felt like the sounds of summer. So I wanted to see what I could do with that sound, and I made some recordings at the Hambidge Center. I would like hear them from one mountain to another, like calling back and forth, or from trees, one tree set of trees to another set of trees, and it's really a great sound. So I timed how long one of those
taking me right to summer.
Right. So I timed how many seconds, and I think it was like 17 seconds. So that helped me give me some structure. And then I decided at some point, I remember when I was walking back after dinner from the dining hall to my cabin where I had a nice piano in a beautiful space, I remember thinking, how can I enlarge upon this? And I realized, oh, if the cicada had an orchestra like I have, then it wouldn't just be limited to that one frequency, the high frequency. And then, so, I mean, it's a mating song, and, you know, they want to give it everything they've got. So I brought in the basses and the low brass, and it kind of fleshed out from there.
So a very local inspiration, something from your own experience and interaction with nature for this.
Yeah, and I always loved summer. You know, of course, the summer I was outside the most. And even when when I was a little girl, we didn't have air conditioning. And I spent a lot of time outside. There's this one sound that I really liked, kind of like, I think it might be a mosquito, but I'm not sure. Anyway, like, you know, there's the high-pitched little glissando there, so I put that into just to give it the sound of the summer. And to me, it was like the earth alive.
What techniques were you using there? Because I've heard of some composers who directly will sample like a recording of insects, but you don't bring any pre-recorded material into this work, do you?
Yeah, I thought about doing that. I gave serious thought to doing that, but it just adds another layer of complication for the performers and the presenters. And I felt like we can hear that by going outside. So I wanted to translate it into the instruments. And of course, this percussion, and you heard the güiro, ch-ch-ch-ch. You know, that's the closest, I guess. And I think maracas, and there's a rain stick in there. And so I had some kind of white noise sounds and rhythmic sounds that I could get with the percussion section. I didn't really need to have the cicadas in there. If I give a pre-concert talk, I'll have my recording, and then people can hear that, you know,
sure,
to see what I was, you know, what I was riffing off of. But yeah, I felt like it was more of a compositional challenge to work with the orchestra itself.
So that's the first movement inspired by cicadas, but there's three other movements to the work as
yeah.
Well. What are the sources of inspiration behind all these?
Well, the second movement, Tawayo River at Night. So the Tawayo River is a tributary to the Amazon, and when I conceived of the title Living, Breathing Earth, I felt that's what I wanted to advocate, that the earth be living and breathing in a healthy way. I mean, it's just literally there's too much carbon dioxide and not enough oxygen. So I decided it would be a good opportunity, I justified a trip to the Amazon, basically, by saying I had to go there for field research. And because that's called, the Amazon rainforest has been called the lungs of the earth. So I'd like to see what that looks like and what that feels like. So my family and I went to a lodge on the Amazon, and the name of the lodge was Tawayo River Lodge. And one day they took us on a boat ride down the Tawayo River and down a tributary to the Tawayo River, even a quieter place. And it was a motorboat, but luckily the motor stopped working. So we were just like floating along with no sound. And I was toward the back of the boat, and I could look up and see all these amazing stars. It must have been a no moon night, because the stars were like, you could almost reach out and touch them. And then on the sides is like a wall of lightning bugs. And then all of that was reflected in the river. So it was like a 360 degree sparkles. Yeah. And so quiet and so peaceful. And so I just wanted to get that sense of the quiet and the kind of the boat floating down. And so it has like it's just in 4-4. It's very simple. And I came up with the chords while I was at the Hambidge Center. I remember those chords, the harmonies, and I had written them down somewhere, and I lost a piece of paper. So I had to start again. And then so I wrote them out, and then I found the piece of paper, and it was the same ones. But those chords, just, I don't know, something about those harmonies, they just came.
So you knew what you wanted there.
Well, it just, I didn't know what I wanted, but it came through me. Yeah, and it I knew what I was looking for.
Well, moving on to the third movement of the piece, what's the story behind this one?
So when we were heading out, I think it was our last day, we were heading on a bigger boat back down towards the Amazon, and the boat stopped at a place where we could get out, I think, and maybe buy baskets or something. I'm not sure why we stopped. But at this place, before we got to the Amazon itself, there was a swirls of yellow butterflies, as if in a vortex of yellow butterflies. And of course, it was a sunny day, and the sparkles on the river and the yellow butterflies are just like so uplifting. And you know, this was becoming an ode to the earth, like a love song to the earth, I kind of call it. And so I wanted to just have that joy, the joyful sound of the energy, the lightness of those butterflies. And even in this third movement, I brought in like birds, you know, flocks of birds soaring as kind of the flying animals, and the joy just by watching them that we feel.
Would it be fair to call this a scherzo of sorts for the
It takes the place of a scherzo. It's almost like, yeah, it's like this slow movement, and now is an upbeat kind of, well, not upbeat, but lively. Yeah, so it functions like that.
Definitely hear the fluttering you were talking about there between these lines being passed among the string instruments and pizzicato here and there, flutes, strings. So did you have any particular inspiration from other composers for that, or was this just...
Well, you know, a lifetime of listening. Mendelssohn, I don't know.
I was going to say Mendelssohn, actually, especially now that you've mentioned. I was thinking, oh, there's this kind of spirited, I don't know, they always say elfin quality with Mendelssohn.
It has that.
And then that brings us now to the final movement of four, which brings the symphony to its close. What's going into this finale?
Well, this is really the planet, the song of the planet itself, like spinning in space. Of course, to us, it's a very large orb spinning slowly and majestically. And I wanted to just get that majestic quality. It just like with the crescendo going up and down for each section of five, it's to me, it gave a sense of time passing and the earth rotating. Of course, I brought back some of the colors of the other movements, some of the cicada sounds, and this is a movement where I kept thinking I had finished it. And I would run across the street to my neighbor and say, "Susan, I finished it. I finished my symphony. I finished the last movement." And then I would come back and I would look at the music again and think, "No, I don't think it's really done yet." So then I write some more, go back again. "I finished it now." I come back across and no, it still wasn't finished. So by the time I did finish it, I feel like it really came to a kind of the majestic conclusion that I was hoping for. Yeah.
A majestic conclusion, you'd say, an optimistic one?
Just awesome. Awesome that we are living on such a planet that is so miraculous and so perfect for us. You know, it's, if it were a few degrees, you know, colder or hotter, especially like we're getting into that area now, you know, people wouldn't be able to live. And this is our habitat. We're perfectly made for it, and it's perfectly made for us. That's why we can live on it. And if we wreck it, people talk about colonizing other planets, but that's not going to happen. It's not going to replace life on Earth. Life on Earth is kind of a one-time deal. You have it or you don't. So it's kind of a lot of those feelings coming in of just awe and appreciation and gratitude. And, yeah, the whole idea of writing it was to remind us that the earth is so precious.
When writing music like this with an environmental inspiration, environmental message, what do you think the strengths of music are as opposed to, say, a protest or an op-ed in a newspaper about raising awareness and getting people concerned?
Yeah, that's a great question. For me, and people who have heard this have told me, the music, it allows us to experience on an emotional level what we're aware of cognitively. And I feel like it deepens our knowledge and it deepens our connection to who we are, transcending our limits and connecting, I don't know, maybe to the creator, to the creation itself. But music, the way I write music, the way I approach music is an emotional approach. It's not really mathematical, at least not cognitively. I think there are connections that can be made. But for me, it comes from inside, and I hope it goes inside the listener. And it doesn't have to go really through the cognitive part of the brain. It can bypass that and connect in a deeper way.
Meira, thanks so much for sharing today, and all the best as you continue connecting about these issues through music.
Thanks for having me, Bradley.
Part of a conversation I had with South Carolina-based composer Meira Warshauer. Excerpts of Warshauer's Symphony No. 1, Living, Breathing Earth, were performed by the Moravian Philharmonic Orchestra under Petr Vronsky and were taken from the 2011 Navona Records release, Living, Breathing Earth. Special thanks to Palmer Recordings for permission to use these excerpts. More information can be found at meirawarshauer.com and at navonarecords.com. For South Carolina Public Radio, I'm Bradley Fuller.